Hello, and welcome to the NVIDIA AI Podcast. I'm your host, Noah Kravitz. In November of 2017, a painting sold at auction for just over $450 million, making it by far the most expensive painting to ever change hands. Salvator Mundi, Latin for Savior of the World, is a portrait of Jesus said to have been painted by Leonardo da Vinci, which explains the nearly $500 million sale price. But even though a panel of experts had determined the painting was an authentic Leonardo, others had their doubts. That same painting had, after all, sold for a mere £45 just a half century earlier. And a full century had lapsed since the last Leonardo painting had been uncovered in 1909. So was Salvator Mundi real, or had its new owner been taken for a $500 million ride? The quest to uncover the truth has led to scholarly articles, two documentary films, and, of course, the use of AI. There's no one better suited to tell the tale of the world's most expensive painting than our guest today. Stephen Frank is a partner at the law firm Morgan Lewis in Boston, where he specializes in intellectual property and commercial technology law. And he's half of the husband and wife team who leveraged a convolutional neural network to determine that, yes, this Leonardo is the real thing. Stephen's here to tell us his fascinating tale, all of which apparently is at least partially due to his self-described addiction to online learning. Stephen, thanks so much for taking the time to join the NVIDIA AI podcast, and welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I will tell the audience, I cribbed liberally from your own writing, your article on IEEE Spectrum, which is linked to in a blog post that our own Brian Caulfield wrote for the NVIDIA blog. So after you're done listening to this, listeners, start with Brian's blog. It links out to Stephen's piece and some other scholarly articles that he authored or co-authored. You can get the whole deep dive. But for now, I want to turn it over to you. And if I could just ask you, just tell us the story about this painting, about how you decided to try to, authenticate it, unravel the mystery. How did this all begin?
Well, it's a nerd's tale. And the nerd's tale starts a long time ago when I started to develop my online course addiction. And it's led me to kind of reinvent myself. I actually majored in chemistry when I was in college. And as an intellectual property lawyer, I've seen many different kinds of technologies. And over the course of a career, gravitated more and more toward computer science and electrical engineering. And when MOOCs, when massive online courses became available and started to really gain currency and traction, I dived in and really sort of reinvented myself to a certain extent, filling in a lot of gaps that I had based on my experience, which was mostly professional rather than academic. I didn't really have much formal training on the computer side. And really in 2012 was when the first MOOC was inaugurated by MIT. Mm-hmm. And it was, funnily enough, it was my wife, Andrea, who encouraged me to dive in. And I did. And it turned out I was rustier than I could possibly have imagined. And it was a tough course. It was electronic circuits, the sort of deep dive MIT undergraduate course in electronics. And boy, was I rusty at math and everything else. But it was really quite a powerful experience to be able to learn in an environment where you could set your own schedule, you could work it in with your other responsibilities. And so I really enjoyed it quite a bit. And that led to taking many, many other courses, really is essentially an engineering undergraduate recapitulation of my academic career.
Right.
Ultimately, culminating in a graduate certificate in artificial intelligence from Columbia. And that was at the end of the summer. I completed that program at the end of the summer of 2018.
Belated congratulations.
Thank you. At which time my wife, Andrea, decided that she was the curator of visual resources at Boston College. And what that means is that she is in charge of the images that art history faculty use to teach courses.
Okay.
And she has a master's in library science and a master's in art history. So she's obviously very well qualified, and she was in that career for over 30 years. But over time, it had migrated from what was really sort of a resource specialty into something that was becoming more and more clerical, because the images, you didn't need to make slides anymore. It wasn't difficult to find good images of artwork. It was really just a matter of buying packages from vendors
that
would supply vast quantities of images. And the kind of expertise that she was used to providing was becoming less and less relevant. So she decided it was time to retire. So this is also in just when I was completing this AI program. And we were talking one day, and she said, I know it's time for me to retire, but what if I have nothing to do?
Yeah.
What if I'm really bored? And the funny thing is, and she denies that this happened, but it's 100% true. Immediately, I realized what we needed to do. We needed to work on something together, because I had a graduate credential from a respected university, and it seemed like with something like that, you should be able to design your own projects, do your own thing, and dive into fun stuff. And at the same time, she has so much talent and so much experience that there had to be a way to sort of combine them. And bam, it sort of hit me that convolutional neural networks have been used to do many things. They are used in self-driving cars. They're used to recognize many different things and classify many different things. Why not paintings? Mm-hmm. Because I like art as well. I certainly have learned much at her knee. And there are many very interesting unresolved controversies in the art world stretching back centuries that really seem like they could be addressed by these newer forms of neural networks, convolutional neural networks, and the newer architectures that are being developed that really were not, people had not really applied them very much in the art area because they're so new and because there's not a lot of venture funding for art world investigation with artificial intelligence. But I thought it might be fun to dive in, and she was game. So we did some research, and it turned out that there was really not a lot that had been done, although there was certainly some work that was done on art analysis, very, very little on authentication. And what we quickly discovered was that one reason for that is that if you want to decide, and what one, I'll tell you at the outset, our initial focus was Rembrandt, because there has been tremendous controversy over Rembrandt's works over the centuries since he lived. And in particular, over the last 50 years or so, many putative Rembrandts were disattributed or deattributed as Rembrandts and assigned to either other artists or unknown. But Rembrandt's known works went from over 700 to fewer than 300 over the course of a few decades. Yeah, and with a lot of controversy involved too, because this Dutch panel that was set up to try to bring some rationality to the Rembrandt scholarship was they had a very heavy pencil, and were very harsh in some of their judgments, and they ultimately reconsidered many of them. But it just threw an already controversial world into a roiling debate among experts with passionate differences of opinion. And tremendous disappointment to a lot of institutions that had what they thought were signature Rembrandts, and now they're told, you know what, it's just some guy, some Dutch guy. We don't know
some who. Dutch guy.
Too bad. You're out of luck.
Not to sidetrack us or get us too deep into the weeds, but the process of determining, well, was this really a Rembrandt or not? Is it, sort of politicking and all of the human messiness aside, is it mostly based on just comparing, this is how Rembrandt painted? We all know this is his brushstroke or his palette or his subject matter or whatever the criteria are. And is it just visually comparing, or are there lesser known techniques that are a big part of it?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is that primarily the expertise that's applied to authentication of a painting is called connoisseurship. Okay. It's a pretentious term. And
I'm going to say it's a loaded word, yeah.
it broadly connotes expertise in exactly what you're talking about in terms of the brushstroke, the style, the pattern of working, but also the objective evidence of where a painting came from, its provenance.
Right.
Is there a paper trail from when it was originally painted to where it is now?
Right.
And remarkably, for many very old paintings, there is. but for most of them, it's imperfect, to say the least.
Got it.
So connoisseurship means that you look at the provenance and learn as much as you can from that. You learn as much as you can in terms of what the artist liked to paint, how the artist went about approaching a work, kinds of subject matter that they favored, and the kind of brushstroke they use, the patterns of working that are visible in the finished work.
Right.
There is certainly a lot of diligence that goes into that, and it's a really scholarly pursuit. But the problem is that the experts can passionately disagree over what is and what is not a Rembrandt or any other sure. artist. And this is where we saw an opportunity to apply AI, because AI might be wrong, but it will always be objective if you train it, if you train a neural network properly. Mm-hmm. So at least to the extent that you have this human element, which is leading to uncertainty, we might be able to contribute to the conversation and not tell the experts that they're wrong, but provide a different perspective that can maybe help resolve disagreements among experts and point to who might have the better conclusion or the better analysis, since they really, these analyses can be all over the place.
Yeah.
And the big problem that we discovered right away when we were looking into how we would approach using AI to analyze paintings is that paintings are generally, especially the ones we're interested in, tend to be pretty big. But the character of the painting that distinguishes one artist from another artist's work is very subtle. So most of the work that had been done with neural networks examining artwork up until the point when we started to dive in had really been at a relatively high level and trying to categorize paintings by style. Is this an impressionist painting? Is this a neoclassical painting? Can you do this automatically? Can you categorize a painting in some way? That's actually a very easy problem in a certain sense, because you're not looking really at fine details. You're looking at sort of the overall character of the painting. And as such, you can get away with a relatively low resolution image of the painting to make those kinds of judgments. But to decide whether something is a Rembrandt versus one of his Dutch contemporaries or one of his students' work, mm-hmm. that is a very, very different problem. And it requires a much finer analysis of very highly detailed areas of a painting. You really do need to be able to look at the brush strokes, and you really do need to be able to look at something at a much more detailed level than a little thumbnail image of a painting is going to be able to give you.
Sure.
So that was the key challenge, was how to approach looking at a painting with a neural network that can only handle relatively small images efficiently, when the size of the image that you really want to look at to examine a painting is much, much bigger.
Right.
So what we decided to do was to break the painting up into much smaller segments and try to analyze those, with the thought that if we look at a whole bunch of different regions of a painting, a manageable size, each one a manageable size for the neural network, and try to classify those, is this a Rembrandt or not? Is this a Rembrandt or not?
Which is, it's the same thing as hot dog or not, really, when you think about it. So,
and it's also the same thing as cancer or not, if you're looking at a biopsy slide.
All right, don't spoil it. That's foreshadowing for later in the episode. We got to keep the listeners hooked. So,
fair enough. But I will say that a lot of the work that we found most right. interesting and most relevant for what we wanted to do came from the medical imaging side rather than from the art side. The art side was a bit of a dead end for us.
Okay.
In terms of figuring out what the technique should be. It was actually the people who were looking at medical images that were doing things like breaking a large image up into smaller patches
right.
and analyzing those separately. And that we kind of followed their lead as far as that
Interesting.
Goes.
Interesting, yeah. So did you set out to analyze the Rembrandt and started training your network for that original task? Or how did you get to actually starting to train up your own CNNs?
So the idea was to try to figure out what we would need to do in order to teach a CNN to distinguish a Rembrandt from a Rembrandt forgery or another Dutch artist's work or any artist's work. And that required two things. So the first thing was to try to find a way to look at just smaller pieces of a painting and then aggregate the classifications of these smaller pieces to draw an overall conclusion. If you know, a majority of the painting looked at piece by piece appears to the CNN to be a Rembrandt, well, then, you know, we say that's a Rembrandt.
Right.
And whereas if less than 50% qualifies, then maybe we say we have our doubts.
Yeah.
The first question was, okay, if we're going to break a painting up into tiles, into subregions, which ones are we really going to need to look at? Because if we look at just, like, let's say the background of a painting, there really isn't that much difference between Rembrandt's background and Hontorst's backgrounds or Flink's backgrounds or other Dutch artists or other artists generally. Especially in a portrait, the backgrounds tend to be pretty similar. And there's not a lot of artist-specific originality to that. So The first challenge was to figure out a way to, on an automated basis, find the image regions that are going to be most relevant for a neural network to look at, on which to base a classification decision. And that was ultimately what led us to use image entropy as a criterion for sifting tiles. Make a whole bunch of tiles. We decompose a painting into many, many overlapping little subregions, but then we pick the ones using this entropy criterion that have enough visual diversity to them that they're informationally meaningful to the neural network.
Right.
And so that was a critical piece. But the other critical piece was really in the art history domain, and this is really Andrea's domain. You picture training a neural network. You imagine training a neural network. It's sort of like teaching a child, is the best analogy that I could really come up with. And people who do this kind of work routinely, this is not a metaphor I made up. It really is like teaching a child. You're trying to teach your child Rembrandt versus everybody else, you know, who versus not a Rembrandt.
Right.
If you imagine teaching a kid to distinguish a Rembrandt from something that's not a Rembrandt, it's probably not all that meaningful to show the kid a Rembrandt and then a Picasso.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or a Rembrandt and a Jackson Pollock or something like that. That's pretty so obviously different that it's not even meaningful. So what we did to train our child CNN to really make fine distinctions between Rembrandt and everybody else was to assemble a training set that consisted of obviously a lot of Rembrandt paintings. And we realized right away we would really need to focus on one kind of painting, one genre, because putting too much together would just confuse our child. Mm-hmm. So we stuck to portraits.
Okay.
And we showed it a lot of Rembrandt portraits, and we showed it a lot of portraits that we knew were not Rembrandt, but were very close. There were Circle of Rembrandt, Rembrandt students, Rembrandt imitators, Rembrandt forgers.
Right.
And gradually moving away from very close to Rembrandt to pretty close to Rembrandt to sort of kind of close to Rembrandt,
right,
giving it enough of a range that it could start to generalize and make distinctions that weren't too fine, but also not too gross. You know, it's sort of an art to figure out what the training set should be. And that's really where Andrea came in, and what allowed us to be successful is this range of proximity to Rembrandt in our data set. And so using this entropy sifting criterion and using this progressive data set that Andrea was able to prepare, using publicly available high-resolution images that fortunately in these days of Wikimedia and generous institutions like museums, which are willing to make these high-resolution images of paintings in their collections publicly available, we were able to do a pretty good job generating quite a large data set, not so much of paintings. We really didn't use that many paintings, but we were able to break them up into many overlapping tiles. So we had tens of thousands of tiles that we sifted with our entropy criterion. And interestingly enough, and this is what fascinates data scientists most about what we've done, is that we're able to get very high accuracy with a relatively small training set in terms of number of paintings, because we decompose them into so many tiles.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, in the neural network area, I like to say quantity is quality.
Right.
Even though you have a lot of redundant information, you keep whacking it over the head over and over and over again with these tiles from a relatively small number of well-chosen paintings. And you can do a pretty good job training it to make these fine distinctions. And we were actually very encouraged, not only with the accuracy on our training and test sets, but then we applied our best models to works that had undergone a lot of attribution controversy over the years, but where the scholarly consensus had finally pretty much settled definitively on yes or no, is it or is it or not, is it not a Rembrandt? And our system was correct, judged 9 out of 10 cases consistent with the scholarly consensus. And the one where we differ from the consensus, we actually think they may be wrong. We modestly question because we are certainly not Rembrandt experts, and we acknowledge others' much greater expertise. But nonetheless, I will say in that one case, it was considered a Rembrandt for hundreds of years, recently deattributed, and it's a spectacular painting called The Man with a Golden Helmet. Mm-hmm. Our neural network classifies that as a Rembrandt almost off the charts, for what that's worth.
Yep. Yep.
At least at 9 out of 10, in any case, we were very encouraged. We extended the work to Van Gogh and ultimately to Leonardo because we were fascinated. We love Leonardo's work as well, Van Gogh's work too. But we were certainly fascinated with the raging controversy over the Salvator Mundi, which Leonardo is known to have painted a Salvator Mundi. But what people have been fighting over is whether this is the one that he actually
Got
painted.
It. Okay.
And for hundreds of years, it was assumed that this is just, you know, it was never really treated. It was mistreated. It was never treated well because it was never really assumed to be a Leonardo for hundreds of years. It was just another painting from around that time by a minor artist. So it was in terrible shape.
Before you dive into that, I want to put my computer, I don't want to use the word nerd, although you said it's a nerd's tale. Let's stick with that. I like the word nerd. I'm going to put my nerd hat on for a second. Were you running all of the computations, setting up your convolutional neural network and training it and getting it right and then creating all the tiles, all the stuff you just described? Where were you, like, what computer were you using? Was it just a home machine you had? Were you doing it at the law firm? Did you have access to a university, you know, supercomputer? Where was all the crunching happening?
The most fascinating thing about AI research these days is that you can do cutting edge AI research on an inexpensive PC clone gaming computer, which is what we have. And it's funny because people have interviewed me and they've asked to see the lab.
Right.
I'll show you the lab. Here it is. You're
like, I can't. I didn't make the bed this morning. I can't show you the lab. I'm sorry. It's on the nightstand.
Well, you know, the thing is, you definitely don't need a supercomputer. You don't need institutional resources. Google Colabs is a fantastic resource, but the kind of performance that you could get on Google Colab is not really all that different from the kind of performance you can get on a PC, just a standard PC gaming computer, as long as it has a GPU, like our NVIDIA GPU.
Yep.
And using that kind of capability makes the difference between being able to do essentially professional research within the, you know, a human lifespan and just having to basically give up because it's going to take too long.
Right.
So this is all done on an inexpensive gaming computer that I can tell you we have never played a game on, although I kind of feel like we should.
My 12-year-old son is somewhere shaking his fist right now.
I will tell you, an inexpensive gaming computer can drive a CNN to eat tiles for lunch and just keep eating.
No, it's amazing. Yeah. So 9 out of 10 on the Rembrandts, and you shifted your gaze, so to speak, to this decades, centuries old controversy around the Leonardo.
It was a very difficult task, Leonardo versus Rembrandt, because Rembrandt painted many paintings. Van Gogh painted many paintings. It was very straightforward to assemble a data set that basically had a pretty fair number of attributed works by the artist we were studying and equivalent works by other artists. Not so for Leonardo. There are fewer than 20 firmly attributed Leonardo paintings, and only a subset of those are really finished enough to be usable for comparative purposes. That was a very, very tall order, and we had to, we describe it in an article that we wrote for a journal called Leonardo. And interestingly enough, and the kinds of assumptions that we had to make and the kind of techniques that we had to use to make do with so few firmly attributed Leonardos, to compare those against many people who painted in a style similar to Leonardo, that was a tall order. And it basically, I think, pushed our technique to the envelope. We aren't able to confirm the accuracy of a Leonardo analysis as we have been with Rembrandt and Van Gogh, because there are so few Leonardos to you need so many to train.
Right.
You can spare very few to test. And so if you're only testing on two or three paintings by Leonardo and maybe 60 by artists other than Leonardo, are you really getting a meaningful result?
Sure.
For a variety of reasons, we think that there's enough cross-validation in the assumptions that we're making and the tests that we performed that we think that we're able to do it. But sort of a key step forward in what we were doing to try to authenticate artwork was not only to give a yay or nay prediction as to whether a painting is or is not by an artist, but to take a deeper look at the painting itself and see what areas of the painting are more or less likely to be by that artist. And that turns out to be very interesting in cases of Renaissance artists and Dutch artists who very often collaborated.
Right.
We sort of have this vision of the solitary genius in his turret painting by himself and producing masterpieces. But in fact, especially during the Renaissance and during the 17th century in the Netherlands, where paintings were being produced as a commodity for the newly wealthy middle classes, there was much more of a factory aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are many signature works by Rembrandt and we think by Leonardo also, but they were a lot less touchy at that time about getting other people involved and painting parts that they didn't really feel like painting, or that were just sort of pedestrian areas. Painting was crap then. You know, the high art of the Renaissance was poetry. Painting was basically, you know, more of a craft.
Right. So you'd have the interns paint the grass in the background, so to speak, and the master might handle the more detailed parts of the painting.
That's exactly right. That was definitely not uncommon. So we developed it, kind of extended our technique so that we're able to look tile by tile on an overlapping basis to try to assign probabilities to different areas of the painting. Now, if you look at something like that, for Van Gogh, who was known to have painted, he didn't have help. He really did paint all of his paintings. And if we start to see different probabilities across a Van Gogh, that means that's really sort of a flaw in our training set. That means that if it's looking at a Van Gogh and sees something that doesn't look like Van Gogh to the neural network, it means it's wrong. It's getting it wrong. And the reason it's getting it wrong is that it really hasn't seen enough details like that during training that it's been able to associate with Van Gogh. Fortunately, it doesn't really come up all that much. The Van Gogh probability maps that we create there aren't too many errors like that. But there's much more variation in Rembrandt. And a lot of times that kind of variation, it's a colorful probability map that we create where these blue areas, the colder the color, the less likely it is to be the artist understudy, and the warmer the color is, the more likely it is. And we see these very interesting patterns of colors in the probability maps that we create. And this is where the combination of our work with traditional scholarship starts to get very interesting. In one of our Rembrandts that we analyzed, a face of his wife that he painted in a portrait was blue.
Okay.
Was supposedly not by Rembrandt. But there's a reason for that. And it turns out that when you look at the scholarship around this painting, what you find is that the face was retouched later on. It was restored. Right. It was overpainted. So it would make sense. That wouldn't necessarily look like a Rembrandt, that our CNN would think that it was painted by a different hand, because indeed it was.
A while back, I spoke to somebody from a company called Goat that is in the business of authenticating sneakers.
Interesting.
I don't know if you know much about the high-end sneaker world these days, but you know, it's huge business, and there are, you get these sneakers that are released in limited quantities, and then on the aftermarket, they shoot up in value, and then people are making, fakes and passing off the fakes all over the place. And so there's actually more than one, but this one company, Goat, is using AI in their stack to help authenticate, is this a real Christian Dior Air Jordan, or is it a knockoff? And as you were talking, and I'm trying to wrap my head, I'll be honest, I know a little bit more about sneakers than about fine art. But as you're talking about this process and thinking about all of the, the context in which these paintings were created, everything from the number of people, involved, because it's not the lone genius in the turret, as you said, to, the restoration process and the paper trail and all the things that might happen between when it was painted now and when it is then. It almost seems so much more multidimensional than trying to authenticate, a sneaker. And I mean, no disrespect to the sneakers, but you're not just authenticating does the details of this image match up in an authentic way, but just all of these layers to the stories behind how the painting came to land on this auction block in the year 2017. It's just remarkable just to listen to you talk about.
What's really quite fascinating about it is you create a probability map for a painting. You train your models. You have this AI model or set of models that you think can do a pretty good job distinguishing works by a certain artist from other works or forgeries or whatever. And you look at a painting and you run it through the system, and it creates this interesting probability map with a pattern of colors. And you look at that, and instantly you want it to tell you a story. Because we're humans, and we kind of think of the world, we understand the world through stories.
Yes.
And we say, "What? There's blue here, there's red here, there's gold here. What story is this probability map telling us?" And what's really important is not to jump to a certain assumption and assume that the first story that strikes you is necessarily the one that is the story of the lived history of this painting, because it may not be. Mm-hmm. What you find when you start to analyze these probability maps is that they can be consistent with a number of different stories. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see it as a complement to the kind of sourship technique we were talking about earlier. To the extent that there are, even if there are different experts who have different opinions, maybe some of those opinions are stories that are more or less consistent with what we have found.
Right.
So again, to the extent that we see a face that is blue, but the rest of the painting is red, well, what is it about that face? Is it, did an assistant paint it?
Right.
Was Rembrandt having a bad day?
Yeah.
A lot of different possibilities. But then when you start to look at the scholarship and start to see what experts have hypothesized about this painting, because really, even though every expert thinks that he or she is right and everybody else is a moron, they're telling ultimately different stories. And that's what when we take a look at an analysis of a painting from the perspective of different areas having different probabilities, we try to see it in terms of a story, and we try to see what other stories experts have told about this painting. And maybe then we can all sort of come to a consensus about it.
I don't want to let you go before I get back to the medical implications of the work you've been doing. You mentioned that kind of early on, you looked to medical image analysis for some ideas and ultimately some techniques and strategies around leveraging CNNs and AI to analyze this visual data. But my understanding is that there may be some things that can be taken from your work to sort of give back, might be overdramatic, maybe not, but to be applied to medical analysis work.
We are actually very excited about the medical imaging side. And this is I like to tell people, we're a diversified enterprise. So, we have our art division and we have our medical image division.
I mean, look, if somebody is going to run professional research out of their house, in the evenings after doing their job as a partner at a law firm, I would hope you'd be diversified. That's all I have to say.
Well, the problem domains could not be more different, but the domain challenges are actually very similar. And we have applied this technique to analysis of medical images. And it, what you can do is you can train the same neural network to distinguish biopsy slides, distinguish cancer from non-cancer regions by the same kind of training. You show areas that are cancerous, areas that are not. And you can produce the same sort of probability map that will basically show you for a candidate image where, if anywhere, there is cancer in this image. And a lot of people are doing that. That's actually not especially new. But this entropy technique, what it lets you do is if you learn the entropy range that a tumor area tends to fall within, then just using entropy before the CNN ever sees a tile from a biopsy slide, you can eliminate all of the tiles that don't fall within that band of entropy that characterizes the tumor that you're trying to look for. And now the CNN has a much easier job because it's only looking at things that are much more likely to be tumor. The nice thing about all this, and I think what sets it apart from the techniques that people are using now, is that you could potentially do a biopsy analysis on an iPhone or an iPad rather than a big workstation, because it's ultimately, once you have the model trained and you are using a relatively restricted set of tiles, the computational operations that you have to perform in order to process a new image, which you can do at a relatively low resolution, it turns out, are pretty straightforward and are easily done on an iPad. So, you know, the vision is that you could potentially crowdsource, expert crowdsource a biopsy that somebody takes in one part of the country, but there aren't experts available with a real expertise for a difficult case to do an analysis very quickly or very easily. You can downsample the image. You can use a much smaller image as a basis for creating tiles. Right. And then you can crowdsource it. Somebody could be on a plane somewhere. The oncologist with the key expertise can just pick up the information and do an analysis very quickly and does not have to be at a workstation or anywhere near where the original medical images were generated. So we think it's got interesting possibilities.
That's excellent. Very cool. Stephen Frank, thank you so much for your time. And I will, I usually at the end ask people if people want to learn more about your work, and I'm going to ask you that, but I'm going to reiterate the article on the NVIDIA blog. It's a great article. It's well-written and sums up the story nicely. But it also links out to other, I think the Leonardo one's there. I'm looking right now at the one that you wrote on IEEE Spectrum, which gets more into, you know, some of the technical details, even in more depth than you get into here. So definitely anybody listening, go check those out. They're fascinating. There's a sidebar about the pathology implications Stephen just mentioned. So that's great. Stephen, anywhere else you would direct people to go to learn more? Or maybe you just want to plug your favorite, you know, your favorite online MOOC for people who want to, you know, pick up the online education bug.
Well, I highly recommend the Columbia Micro Masters in AI program given through edX. It's a marvelous program. But we do have 4 peer-reviewed research articles that are linked to in the NVIDIA blog piece. There are a couple of others that, well, one is in process, one is available on ResearchGate. And right now we are working on Raphael drawings to see if our technique will work on drawings as well as paintings. And hopefully we will be generating some additional wisdom soon.
Very cool. That spares you from having to hear my lame joke about, you know, well, we'll have you back on when you figure out how to authenticate NFTs. Raphael drawings are much more interesting. I don't throw eggs at me, all the techno people listening. But yeah, Stephen, again, thank you. This is a terrific conversation. I'm going to say thank you one more time, but the documentaries, the movies that are in the article, were you involved in those?
Oh, the funny thing is there's a movie that has just come out called The Lost Leonardo. Mm-hmm. We were interviewed by the filmmaker for 3 hours about our work with Leonardo. In fact, he was one of the people who asked to see the lab, and we showed him the lab. Nice. We actually showed him, and they filmed the lab.
Nice.
But unfortunately, we wound up on the cutting room floor because that film sounds, we're very eager to see it. It sounds like a great film, and it really kind of exposes some of the seamy underbelly of the art world in terms of the grubby economics of it.
Oh, I love it. I love seamy, grubby economics. Or I love watching them.
Well, you know, to the extent that this movie kind of divides the world up into good guys and bad guys, which it seems to do, perhaps it's a good thing we're on the cutting room floor, because our analysis is not, yeah, this is definitely a Leonardo, or no, this is definitely not a Leonardo. It's kind of nuanced, so it didn't really kind of fit into the framework. But I kind of feel like, you know, one foolish boast could have cast us with the bad guys, and that we wouldn't have wanted that.
No, you have work to do. You have work to do.
Indeed.
Well, we'll find a way to talk again. But again, thank you for telling this incredible story. In progress still, and good luck with the Raphaels.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.